Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk. With me today are Austin Bay and Jim Dunnigan. Austin is an author, columnist, blogger, and contributor to StrategyPage.com. Jim is a military analyst, consultant for the U.S. military, and well-known author. On Strategy Talk, we discuss current events with our own unique twist. We report news as history. Jim and Austin, welcome this morning. There's been a lot of controversy around General McChrystal and his request for additional troops. The Obama administration right now is trying to make a decision of whether to send the troops over there. Are the troops really needed?
Yes. The problem is that, as with many wars, there's a lot more politics involved in this than there should be. President Obama has a far-left wing to worry about, and many if not most of them, want us to be out of Afghanistan no matter what. Now, what is getting generally lost in all of this is that the big problem is the heroin gangs. Most of the world heroin is coming out of Afghanistan. Voters are beginning to notice this because people who vote tend to live in the suburbs, and suburban kids are starting to die from heroin overdoses. Now, this was unheard of a few years ago. Heroin, for a while, was in short supply, mainly because the Chinese, the Burmese, and the Thais had gotten rid of the Golden Triangle, had shut it down. Then it got ran out of Pakistan, where it moved to in the 80s, and then there was all the chaos. With the Civil War in Afghanistan in the 90s, it picked it up towards the late 90s, and then the Taliban fell again, and it was also again in disarray, but now it's built itself back up, and they're basically subsidizing the Taliban. There's constant debate over how much money is the Taliban getting from the drug gangs versus their other illegal sources of income, plus the Islamic charitable contributions from the Persian Gulf. But a significant, from what I hear, a significant amount of the money and support is coming from the drug gangs, who have a tremendous incentive not to be put out of business. I mean, these guys are making more money than they ever, in their wildest imaginations, ever expected to see. People forget, Afghanistan is the poorest country in Eurasia. This place is the outback of the outback. They are poor. They have the lowest life expectancy in Eurasia, which is saying something. You have to go to Africa to find people who live less long than Afghans, and that's only by a couple of years in the worst African countries. So we are talking about taking the candy away from an armed baby. And this is the real job that has to be done, and this is what McChrystal wants the troops for. And most Afghans do not like the drug business because they have a huge drug addict problem. The stuff is so cheap over there, not just the heroin, which is expensive to refine, but the opium, the raw material that you scrape right off the poppies. That stuff is dirt cheap, and there's over a million addicts in Afghanistan, a poor country, and the people don't like it. In fact, the drug business tends to be concentrated in one province, Helmand. Now, all that activity you're hearing about, the Taliban moving north, a lot of that has to do with the drug gangs trying to move their operations out of Helmand, which is basically under siege right now. This past summer, the military operations did not get a lot of attention in the news, but they banged up the drug business quite a bit. They basically seized tons of heroin, smashed up many of the processing labs, and cut back on a lot of the poppy crop, which even the UN, who keeps track of these things, admit, you know, took a sharp drop last year. A lot of this had to do with the battle in Helmand, and the gangs are trying to move out of Helmand now. Now, the drug angle never gets talked about. But it's the basic element that is driving what is going on in Afghanistan. No heroin, no Taliban, or much less Taliban. Let's say enough Taliban that even the Afghan police and army could take care of. So a lot of people in the Democratic Party want to ignore heroin, or maybe they're addicts, who knows, and simply want us to get out of Afghanistan with the hope that, you know, it'll all go away.
Which it's not.
No, of course it's not. Heroin's still here. Heroin's here, and more of it's going to be here if we don't do something about stopping the supply. You know, it's like wiping out smallpox and polio. All right, let's be frank about this. If we do chase it out of Afghanistan, which the Afghans want us to do, and the Pakistani, the Pushtun tribes on the other side of the border, they sort of went along. They didn't declare jihad against the Pakistani government like they're doing, like some of the tribes are doing now. When the government decided we do not want the heroin trade in the tribal territories of Pakistan, it went. They got rid of it. I mean, two other countries, or groups of countries, have gotten rid of the heroin trade. And if we get it out of Afghanistan, it'll go to Central Asia. But it'll be somebody else's problem. All right, we may get involved up there. But at least it won't be linked with the Taliban. The right. Taliban is another problem, the Pushtun problem, which nobody wants to talk about. I mean, the whole situation over there is about two problems that nobody wants to talk about. Heroin, which is fairly obvious, and the Pushtun, you know, tribal problem, which is sort of like the Kurds of the East, which nobody wants to talk about. They're Kurds who are so disorganized, they don't even want their own country. They just want to raise hell, if not with outsiders, with each other. I mean, Austin Gowan, because he knows more Pushtuns than I do.
Well, nobody wants to talk about it. I'll talk about it.
I'm just saying, so few people know about it. And the Pushtun problem is to underline the heroin. You wouldn't have a heroin there if you didn't have the Pushtun tribal, you know, situation.
Well, let me take this from a different tack. What Jim has said about the drug trade is it's absolute gospel. I mean, the evidence for what he's described to me is utterly convincing. And also the other point that Jim makes is if you dried it out, it's just going to move. Because it didn't, I mean, it becomes someone else's problem, kind of, sort of, but it's not the problem that you have in Afghanistan or along the Afghan-Pakistani border with the Pushtun tribes. Now, let me give you another read, and I have this in a column I wrote, 3 weeks ago, I guess. It's up on the On Point section of Strategy page, and it talks about what has happened to the battlefield after Mumbai 2008. And just to refresh everyone's memory, that's when, if you want to call it Lashkar-e-Taiba, if you want to call it Kashmiri Islamo-fascist, if you want to call it somebody linked to Al-Qaeda, whatever, but that was that absolutely heinous terrorist attack in Mumbai, Bombay, in November of 2008, which was intended, I believe, to do what the attack on New Delhi in December of 2001 almost did, which was ignite a war between India and Pakistan, and it failed again. This time, it failed with, and I say this with, you know, there's a degree of speculation in what I'm saying. You can go and read both Indian newspapers during the immediate 4 or 5 months after the Mumbai attack, and see the background for this. You can see this in some things that the Pakistani government has done subsequent to that attack. Is the Indian government said no more, and if you don't solve your problem, speaking here to the Pakistanis of Islamabad and Karachi, Punjabi, Sindh, call it the, is that right, Jim? I mean, that's basically
Sindh and Punjab, yeah.
Yeah, so, well, okay, that's the two largest, I think, groups, not the only ones, but if you don't
solve that's where 80% of the population are, the flatlanders.
Yeah, well, but the thing is, you don't solve the problem, we're going to solve it, and you will not like the way we solve it. And that can mean a lot of things, but everybody, I ran this past a couple of my army buddies on, all right, let's do a quick game on a India-Pakistani war, and let's think about a small nuclear exchange as a possibility. But who wins? And the Indians, if you want to call it a win, but they, most of what is Pakistan doesn't exist as Pakistan anymore, even if the Indians make a lurch of 80, 100, 120, 150 kilometers and say, okay, now let's talk about attacks on New Delhi and Mumbai by the terrorists. Yeah. Anyway, the situation is that the Pakistanis have since then, and this is something the strategy page has covered, I think, better than any other military and military intelligence news source. And the one thread of it predates November 2008, and that's us picking up and commenting on the increasing number of predator attacks in Pakistan that Pakistan talks about, the Pakistanis openly admit to discussing. Also, Pakistani, spinning up Pakistani response to Taliban, Pakistani Taliban militants, in the Swat Valley and moving out of the tribal areas and out of some of the other border areas. But certainly after November of 2008, after you get past the emotion-tinged time between India and Pakistan, you see the Pakistani army do what? Say we're going into Waziristan. Say what? We may even move into parts of Balochistan down to Quetta, where Al-Qaeda is supposedly hanging out. And Jim can discuss what saying you're going to do something to the Baluchis usually means in this part of the world. But in other words, choices were made with great Indian insistence by the Pakistani government. Now, visualize the battlefield as this. It's not a simple battlefield. You're talking about an extremely complicated one. You're talking about the Hindu Kush. You're talking about extremely rough terrain and culturally and tribally fragmented human terrain to go with the topography. But you've got a large Pakistani movement from the south. And you've now got a situation where there's the drug trade component, but if one big pincer is moving, it's time to have the anvil reinforced, and that anvil is NATO forces or U.S. forces in the north. I think this is something that I have not heard General McChrystal address. Again, I'm putting this as a interpretation of what's going on the battlefield in addition to some of the other issues that we pointed out on strategy page. But this is a change from November of 2008, and I see this as another rationale for a troop increase. I'm not sure that 40,000 is enough. The 40,000, whatever, that's what McChrystal has currently asked for, according to what I've read. But nevertheless, I think that this is you have an opportunity here. You're not going to quote unquote solve the drug issue. You're going to have to encourage a what I'll call third generation Pushtun. I'm no longer Pushtun Taliban, but Pushtun leaders, emerging Pushtun leaders, that they must reach if they're going to survive as leaders and have some degree of remaining tribal authority. They're going to have to reach a new accommodation with the Pakistani government and the Afghan government, such as it is, that first of all, you're not going to harbor Al-Qaeda. You're not going to launch attacks in Islamabad or New Delhi and Mumbai. You're going to police your own radicals. Now, that may be too much at the moment for this new Pashtun leadership cadre to bear, but that's why there's a war. That's why there's a fight going on. And over the next year, I see this that is the diplomatic result of a tough year's fighting. I think that is what both the Pakistani government, the Afghan government, and NATO, as personified by General McChrystal, should be looking for. We're going to have a tough fight, but those are going to be the conditions, and it's going to reach a new enforced agreement with the Pushtun tribes policing their Islamo-fascist components. And one other point that I would make on this, they really do have something to give up, along with the Baluchis, which is the foreigners and Al-Qaeda. They don't like foreigners. Foreigners have paid them, we suspect, millions of dollars to help protect them. They really have a real negotiating tool. That's an ace in the cave, I suppose, instead of ace in the hole that they've got to give up, which is the senior Al-Qaeda leadership. And I'm going to bet you that Al-Qaeda's leaders are aware of that.
There's two other angles to this. First of all, a lot of the unrest in among the Pushtun tribes, there's 40 million Pushtuns in that area. Two-thirds of them are in Pakistan. One-third are in Afghanistan, where they make up the largest minority. They're about 40% of the population in Afghanistan. They're, 7 or 8% in Pakistan. The younger leaders in the Pushtun tribes have used the Taliban. They're not the first one. The current elders, got their current power by becoming Mujahideen and getting involved in Afghanistan during the 80s. And so now karma's a bitch, as they say. The past is coming around to bite them in the butt. The younger guys see the Taliban and the drugs, the money there, as a way to basically leapfrog in the tribal hierarchy. It's always been a big deal among the Pushtun tribes to become a warlord, to gain loot. Loot is a big deal, stealing something, basically. I mean, if you're dirt poor and you got a gun, hey, it follows naturally. Anyway, and what's been going on, especially on the Pakistan side of the border, is this generational struggle for tribal power. Now, the Pakistanis know how to play that. They've been breaking down the tribal power in the tribal territories, which is that huge swath of basically all the territory along the Afghan border, for decades now, but it's slow going. And all of a sudden they find out all these older tribal leaders that they have cultivated carefully over the years are losing their power to these younger guys who have all this drug money or into this Taliban thing, which is great PR because it attracts guys to their cause. And if they get some cash, first it was from Al-Qaeda, now it's direct. They have their own fundraisers operating over in the Persian Gulf, raising money. They started basically criminal scams, opened old mines that were closed, gem mines, illegally cutting, forests down and what have you. They become warlords. They have loot. And that brings followers, guys with guns, or guys without guns when they give a gun. Now you've got a guy who owes you something. That is a big problem, and that's something the Pakistanis don't really want to talk about it. I mean, it's definitely a skeleton in their closet and real dirty linen. But if you read the Pakistani media, it comes right out. They have, they're fine with discussing it among themselves, even though they're doing it in English. The other problem is the support for Al-Qaeda in southwestern Pakistan, which is Baluchistan, with a Baluchi tribe. They're related to the Pushtuns, but they're not Pushtuns. And they have generally, over the generations, the centuries, kept themselves apart from the Pushtuns. I mean, there are some bad relations, but the Baluchis have been very successful in staying out of it. The Baluchis are currently fighting the Pakistani government for a bigger share of the natural gas and oil fields, the only, such wealth that Pakistan has. Pakistan's bought off most of the tribes, but not all of them. And that's an ongoing, soap opera if you follow it. Well, we follow it a bit in Strategy Page, the highlights, as it were, but my God, you can make a hell of a mini-series out of it, what's going on down there. But the thing is, they talk about bin Laden hiding out in Baluchistan. He's not hiding out with the Baluchis. There are still a million or so Afghan refugees from the 1980s whom the Pakistanis have not been able to get to go home. They've still got several million of these refugees who came across the Pakistan and said, hey, it's richer here than back in Afghanistan. I think I'll stay. There are also problems with a lot of the refugees. In Christ, it was, 10 million? It was a huge number, millions and millions of refugees who came across during the 80s. A lot of them, when they went back, they found out somebody else was sitting on their property, and there were big problems with that. So a lot of the families that have since found out, most of them have gone back, but those who have not gone back have not gone back for the simple reason that they found out that their property is now owned by somebody else with guns, and they've set up lives on the Pakistan. I mean, they're all Pushtuns on both sides of the border, so there's no great cultural disconnect. So it was not a huge deal, you know, to settle down on the other side of the border. Basically, the Pushtuns don't really recognize the border, which a British guy by the name of McMahon drew, you know, in a drawing room in London, as the saying goes. The Pushtuns never paid much attention to it. But the Al-Qaeda has apparently paid those refugees groups down in Baluchistan well to protect them, and that's where apparently he's hiding out, because the next most likely hiding place, Waziristan, north Waziristan and south Waziristan, where the Mahud tribe is up to their necks in Taliban activity, they're surrounded by the Pakistani army and are in the process of being invaded. So that would be a bad place for bin Laden to be hiding out right now. There have been rumors that he is basically hiding out in a Pushtun neighborhood in Karachi, which is always a possibility, a remote one. But chances are he has, and probably has been, you know, the story will eventually come out, been hiding out all this time, as many people have reported, in Baluchistan. And this is one reason why Pakistan is very nervous about the CIA, the Air Force, the CIA, whatever, saying they're going to move their UAV Predator attacks and searches into Baluchistan, because apparently some of the money that Al-Qaeda has paid to secure their secret location has gone to the ISI, that's Pakistani intelligence, and people in the Pakistani government, and there are many of them who are basically Islamic radicals or conservatives. So it's a very nasty situation over there, but it's coming to a head. I mean, those people who want to know how the war is going, well, it is going, and it's going in different places. And I think McChrystal wants at least 40,000 additional troops so that he will be a major player when it reaches the third act.
Jim, let's go back to the Al-Qaeda card. Do you see the Al-Qaeda card as I laid it out as being something that Baluchis, Afghan refugees, Pushtuns can play to offer to give up in a scenario that I...
That's always been a possible, but it really comes down to what specific group has been is safeguarding Zawahiri and bin Laden and, you know, half a dozen other guys who are still at large. The tribal customs, you know, the hospitality rule, a lot of those things still play, but I think you're right that they've been wearing out their welcome. Hundreds of Al-Qaeda foreigners, you know, have been killed in the last 2 years simply because they wore out their welcome. You know, they married local women, they went into business for themselves, they weren't Pushtuns, they got in tribal disputes. Now, who's a Pushtun going to back between an Uzbek Al-Qaeda guy, you know, from Central Asia, who's got a beef with your second cousin? You know, no contest.
He's going to back his second cousin. Look, the welcome's been worn out, and I think the signs of that even go back.
And even the mass media are catching up with us and saying, hey, you know, there's not much Al-Qaeda in Al-Qaeda land anymore.
No, and it's you see some of these anti-foreigner, and by that, I don't mean Americans, I don't mean Dutchmen, I don't mean Indians, you know, the thing is, they mean Al-Qaeda. You said Azbek,
yeah.
Uzbek, Tajik,
Chechens, Arabs. The Arabs are the worst as far as
they're concerned. Oh, yeah, and they, you know,
they're contemptuous of the Afghans.
It's because these guys know they get snubbed by those folks as being hillbillies. I'm talking about the tribes. I actually have a great deal of sympathy for some of the way that these tribes have been treated, and their perception that they've been mistreated is an accurate one. Here are these guys showing up, paying them millions of dollars to hide them. They've gotten their money. Now they become a hot commodity. Jim touched on some of the social issues and mores issues that they have tread on. That happened in Anbar province among tribes in Iraq. It's certainly happened in Afghanistan and Pakistan as well. And there were reports from early 2006 of the battles going on with the tribes kicking them out. You know,
this is how one Pushtun, an Americanized Pushtun, explained it to me. He said, "Imagine if you're living in the 14th century, you know, in Afghanistan, you know, you're among people who rarely leave the valley they were born in." And all of a sudden, there are these airplanes. Well, first of all, you get TV, and you realize, holy crap, there's another world out there. That changes things. But on top of that, these foreigners come in who are very religious, and at first, well, this is good. Hey, this is novel. Foreigners who are devout Muslims. But then it turns out they're more devout than you are, and they start telling you how to be a Muslim, and it goes downhill from there.
Just on a personal side on this, I served with a Pakistani officer who was actually from the Masudi tribe, and he would use that as a last name. Fascinating, absolutely fascinating fellow. Ultimately, he was a Sandhurst graduate, and he had a degree from Oxford. So if you don't think that this is somebody who made the leap from, he would have said, as a matter of fact, he did say the 12th century to the...
To the 20th.
But the stories of growing up are very much in line with what Jim was, his Pashtun source was describing.
The army in Pakistan has always been seen as a way out for an ambitious push.
Absolutely.
You can join as a private, learn how to read and write, and end up in Sandhurst.
And the military was looking for bright young men from those tribes, too.
Yeah, they are disproportionate. They're about 15 or 20% of the military, which is one reason why the Pakistani military has been reluctant to invade the tribal territories, because they're afraid that their worst, you know, nightmare is a lot of these Pushtun troops deciding to mutiny. And the last thing they need is a mutiny. But in the end, 85% of the population of Pakistan is non-tribal. But the tribes have a reputation going back thousands of years of kicking the crap out of the lowlanders, the people in Punjab and Sindh. And in fact, the Hindu Kush mountain, that name means death to Hindus. That's where the killers come from. I mean, so you can't, you know, we can ignore this, but they don't.
Right. Right. Now, Austin, why hasn't NATO kicked in more troops?
Pussies.
Have you noticed that the Dutch and the Danes have comparatively robust rules of engagement from some of the other? If you guys know, other than there's the British and U.S. troops certainly bear the brunt of the fighting. I will say that in my own
the Anglo-Saxon troops. Includes the Australians and the Canadians.
Canadians have been.
Well, even the Germans are fighting now. They quietly, let the troops loosen.
I'm not going to. My position on this is to encourage France and Germany and Italy to accept their share of this of this war, and of course, I think the criticism of their governments and the rules that they've been proposing their soldiers is absolutely due. I just wanted to tell a quick story, is that the Dutch unit operating in the southern Iraq, when I was serving in Iraq, I was very impressed with that. Extremely professional, and I noticed some things we've had on the strategy page about the Dutch soldiers with their long hair and the like. Not when they were deployed as soldiers, they were just absolutely crack, and they continued that in Afghanistan. To answer your question and take it where the question really leads, is the part of the politics of having NATO there, Dan, was to show that it was a allied effort, not simply a U.S. effort. It's more than, and also more than an English-speaking effort. It was, but that is where the truth of the matter is, it's an American corps with strong participation by Canadian, Australian, and British, with some supplementary satellite participation. And as you further away you get from the hottest areas, you would find the countries that were there. Wasn't Germany, I think, originally given a mandate? The Germans,
they're in the north.
They're running into construction teams, weren't they?
Yeah, well, they're in a fight now in the north, because they basically were in the way of the Taliban push to bring the drug business north. So So that sort of motivated the Germans. Well, A, the fact that they were getting attacked more, and finally the government said, all right, you could have all these restrictions on, you know, a guy could give a bunch of Taliban could roll by you with their guns as long as they didn't fire, you couldn't fire on them. It was ridiculous. You know, Taliban could surround you as long as they didn't open fire, you couldn't fire back.
The original mandate is that they were there as something like glorified provincial reconstruction teams.
Yeah, the Taliban came to them with their drug buddies, you know, looking to expand the drug business up north. But the big problem with the NATO countries is they simply don't have the resources. They cut their military budgets big time after the Cold War ended. Belgium, for example, is cutting it another 10%. They have soldiers in Afghanistan, not many, and the soldiers, it's a big scandal, they don't even have enough protective vests to go around. And they're not even in a hot area.
Great Britain makes the 2% of GDP spent on defense.
And that's supposed to be the standard for all of NATO.
That's right. The United States does. Who else does out of that?
Well, France is close to 2%, but that's it. France, Britain, and the United States, I don't know, Canada's up there.
So the thing, even though the Canadians slowly... 2 years ago, began ratcheting it up. They're nowhere near meeting the NATO commitments. Dan, let me push your question really to where. What do you do? How do you bring NATO more forcefully into the battle? And if you take the point I made about the change in Afghanistan since November of 2008, and I think that history is going to help make reinforce some of the things that I've said that I believe are going on the battlefield. I think India's diplomatic political action and background pressure has been played a huge role in what's going on the battlefield now. Is that okay? So that's really the end of the Bush administration. The Bush administration is going to be replaced by the Obama administration. Now the pressure to activate and lead NATO is on the Obama administration. And one of the things that the Obama campaign complained about is that the Bush administration had quote-unquote alienated allies. We were unpopular in Europe, unpopular, okay. It is on President Obama to use his diplomatic and political resources to energize our NATO allies. And that's what to make instead of this being a token forces or a political entity which is primarily militarily supported by the United States and Great Britain, to make it a genuine NATO effort. That should be a important diplomatic goal within the alliance for the Obama administration.
Yes,
do I see that going on? I don't
see
it going on.
There's one big problem. The NATO countries have military forces on paper that are not capable of deploying. They had built up their forces as basically another form of social welfare. It was a jobs program. And we reported this in Strategy Page a lot, that whenever they try and deploy overseas, which NATO was never really designed for, it was a mutual defense organization in case somebody invaded the NATO countries. That obviously went out when the Soviet Union fell apart. But this whole idea of going to Afghanistan, they just aren't equipped for it. And that's embarrassing to admit. And a lot of them would rather avoid that embarrassment by saying, well, no, for whatever reason they can make up. So Obama going begging to them is begging to the beggars.
He's asking for arms
from people who haven't got it.
Jim, the thing is, Germany have retained sufficient forces that if its government wanted to make the effort, you could put two strong Jaeger Brigade,
But they're in the middle of a recession with high unemployment. Where are they going to get the money?
I got it. The same thing goes over.
Out of a parliament dominated by Greens and former communists.
Well, the thing is they've got the power and they've got the resources to do it if they have the will. And this comes back, though, to the Obama administration. Which is,
politician, he made promises he couldn't keep. What else is there?
Well, then you just said what I said. I saw no signs of him making those efforts, and I think that that is going to be a stiff historical judgment on his administration.
Oh no, he's a smart guy, and I'm sure somebody gave him a little briefing showing him the defense spending of the NATO countries and the current state of their armed forces, and pointed out to him, you're going to go and ask for a loan from people who are basically broke militarily.
He can push for a change, and this is going on in a de facto way. Maybe it's going on behind the scenes. He can push for a change in their rules of engagement. He can push for a change in the way
he got that. He apparently got that. The Germans, nobody's giving the Germans credit, and the Germans are kind of ashamed of it, politically in terms of the mass media over there. But they basically said, okay, we'll fight. Now, the troops needed no encouragement. That was very unpopular with the German military. They're being sent over there and being mocked by their NATO allies, especially the British, saying, ha-ha, great German soldiers, what are you guys doing? Sitting up there drinking beer and, doing nothing. Now they're doing something. That is a big thing. But getting the Germans to send over a couple of more brigades, then you get into very serious, money problems and reason. Because they basically have to hire, half the Ukrainian, transport fleet to fly them down there. The Ukrainians are the only ones making money out of all this, because the Europeans haven't got the airlift, to move the kind of military, equipment and supplies that are needed to support the troops they already have there. They just haven't got it. I think Obama should talk more to, Bill Clinton, because Clinton found himself in the same situation. Once he got in office, he had all the left-wingers in his party, asking you, he said you'd do this, you said you'd do that, and reality hit him straight in the face, and he ended up a centrist president, which Obama's learning that, despite all his lefty buddies from his younger days, that's where he's going to end up.
Well, Obama went to Columbia, Jim, just like you did.
Yeah, look how I turned out. It could be very different. his problem is, as I point this out to people, the worst mistake you can make is to believe your own bullshit.
I just indicted myself too. For those listening to this, I went to graduate school at Columbia. Jim,
there
got
you go. Well, I keep not get quiet about that. See, I learned diplomacy at Columbia. The problem is, you make promises, especially about something as remote and expensive as Afghanistan. You should know in the back of your head that I'm not going to be able to keep these. And he apparently hoped that, Bush won the war in Iraq for me while nobody was looking. The Bush luck will work out in Afghanistan. Maybe, but you got to make the same kind of investment.
Right.
And there's no victory on the cheap.
Well, it will be definitely interesting to see what happens over the next few weeks, and I'm sure we'll be back talking about it again when the decision comes out. We've used up our time, gentlemen, so we'll see you next time.
All right. Take care, Dan.
All right. Bye.